being present. Now that's some serious work. That's some serious giving of yourself. Because it's not always fun, easy, and little butterflies in your tummy. That's not what's going on. So am I going to grow and mature in these areas of my life? And that's been one of the biggest areas for me in my marriage, is growing up and maturing in my marriage. I didn't have a clue about what it meant to be married, be in a committed relationship, to be faithful to one man. You know, what an order. I can't go through with it. I wanted to be those things, but completely incapable of pulling that off. Because like I talked about earlier, if the heat gets on, or if you make me mad, I'm going to go find some strange baby. You understand me.
They all understand you.
Okay. Or I'm going to go find somebody to pay attention to me because you're not. Or whatever. You know, real immature stuff. But it seems like a good idea at the time. How did I get off on that? I have no idea. I felt like Tom just then. Oh, we're talking about worshiping. Sentiment. Getting sentimental. Relationships. And I used to worship the past. I'd vision of what things should be in every area of my life. I mean, it's nuts. Not being present with what is. Paying attention to what is currently today. And I like what it talks about in 55. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. And again, I mean, the thing that has created that within me is willingness to work with other drunks, willingness to pray, and to get quiet. When I would get quiet, Don told me one time that if you want to know what your relationship with God, how you feel about God, if you want to know what that's all about, all you got to do is watch how you treat other people. And I was still very a steamroller with people. And very little patience, very exacting in a lot of ways, very rigid. And that's what my meditative life was like. I would, when I would get quiet, if my mind went somewhere else, which is where it's going to go, I'd get really angry at myself, and I'd jerk it back. There's nothing calm or gentle or peaceful about it. I mean, it was just angry. And anger at myself, and anger that meditation was so hard, and I thought that I should be able to, you know, once I started meditating, that I should be able to float in spiritual nirvana pretty quickly, you know, because I'd read these great meditation books, and they seemed to be getting it, and why isn't it happening like this for me, you know, now, I want it now. And I still don't have a lot of what they described when I read those books. But when I sit quietly now, it's peaceful. My mind takes off in 1,000 different directions, and I just bring it back, and it's okay. Sometimes it doesn't go very far, very often, and sometimes it's just on parade, man. It is on tour. And thinking about everything and what I'm going to do later today and how I'm going to handle stuff that hasn't even happened. What I'm going to say, you know, if they say this, I'm going to say that. You know, all that kind of stuff. I'm going to get my team straight at work, and I'm going to give them the come to Jesus today. You know, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff goes on in there. But it's just quiet. And the thing that I use is just a single word. And sometimes I'll use a phrase. But I just say that over and over and over again. And it's just simple. For me, the simple has been the best. I used to think I needed to do very wordy prayers, and I can't. So I just keep it simple. Simple mantra or just one word. And I use that just over and over. And what that does is it builds a place of quiet within me. And it pretty much sustains me throughout the day. And it's a place where I can retreat to. And I don't always retreat to it. Because sometimes I get excited by controversy and want to jump in and play. Or I get distracted. Or whatever. But that is there. That little nest within. That gets it's my responsibility to create it. I started to realize how selfish I am in my relationship with my Creator. It's easy for me to pray when I'm in a lot of pain. Or I'm frightened. I'll pray. When things are going good, when things are just, you know, hopping along, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, I'm not really running into any problems, things are kind of going along, I'm fairly happy, I'm not praying very much. And in a prayer time, I started to realize how selfish I am. That really my prayer life and my communication with my Creator is when it's convenient for me. And when it's comfortable for me. And when it makes sense to me. Or when I really need God. Then I want God to help me. You know, but carrying him on into the everyday, day in, day out, daily life has been a new experience for me in the last year and a half or so, being really consciously aware of how I don't want to be so selfish in my relationship with my Creator. I want to access that and participate in that relationship on a daily basis and not just give it lip service. And I used to go into meditation a lot looking for an answer. And that's changed too in this last year and a half. Now I just go there to be there. And it's a very, I hate to use this word because it's just too touchy-feely. But it's an adoration thing. I'm just adoring. And gratitude and adoring and loving. And that's it. And it's great. Love it. Makes things a lot easier. And I feel closer to everything. To people in AA, to my husband, to my son, to people at work. I don't feel so insane. So it's just a nice way to go. And that's what has happened. The consciousness of my belief has come to me. As a result of just being willing to start at that simple place where I didn't understand anything, and it's still very much of my limited understanding, but it's light years from where I was. And the relationship that I have with my Creator today, I wouldn't have thought that possible back then. I couldn't even conceive of it. Couldn't even conceive it. And I like this. It used to make me mad, of course. But that last sentence on 57, it says, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. I'm like, why do I have to draw near first? Can't he just come up to me first? That's a hard term again, you know. So, but again, it's the nature of the relationship. Read about the actor. After the A, B's, and C's, are you like, oh yeah, that's me. I still use this all the time, and I love the first requirement, that am I convinced that any life run on self will can hardly be a success, and in my case, absolutely will not be a success. Am I convinced of that? And yeah, I'm convinced. And that's what happens. If I'm running the show, I'm absolutely in collision with other people, even when my motives are good. And I can get fooled by this all the time. frequently. I think my motives are good and I'm doing the right thing, but really I'm being a self-seeker again. Under the auspices of I'm trying to help, or I'm just trying to do the right thing. But usually, still sometimes behind that is I want to look good or I want my way. So, whenever I get into a jam today, if I go put myself in this, it's me to a T. It describes me to a T, and it doesn't even matter what the situation is. It always fits. And it always, and I've read it 100 times, and it always brings me smack back to I'm the problem. It's not other people. It doesn't matter what they're doing. A recent thing that just happened, my ex-husband, Steve, passed away last September. And he died of cancer. He had lymphatic cancer. And he was pretty well off. And he was living with this woman, and I didn't like her. And I liked his third wife. She rocked. I was wife number two. Wife number three was good. I liked wife number three. She got my stamp of approval. Wife number four, I didn't like her. And I wish I had that inventory with me, because I'd read it to you. So he passed away, and he had a lot of money. And I found out after the fact that that they were not married, and that she was representing herself as being his wife and representing herself legally that way and in court documents, and you're dealing with a lot of money. I found out that she had threatened his health while he was ill. If you don't leave me this stuff, who's going to pull your head out of the toilet? You know, and he's going through chemo and stem cell transplant surgery. All this stuff's going on. You know, he had a beach house, and she nickered that out of him, took it away from my son and gave it to her, changed the will around, and it was just all this stuff. She made all these changes when Steve was really ill. And in my opinion, took advantage of him. And when I found out about this, I went into a rage. And I hadn't felt that in years. In years. It had been a long time. And my bear, as Don would say, came out. And I was absolutely, in my mind, 100% justified. And I was ready to go find her and hold her up against the wall by her neck and throttle her. It was that kind of, I'm going to kill her. And I can just kind of feel it now. And that was nothing compared to what was going on at the time. And I felt completely justified. You know, she has robbed my son. She's taken from my son, you know, my ex-husband who I came to love. I loved him more sober than when I was married to him, who I'd come to love dearly and have this incredible relationship with. You know, I didn't know that was going on, and I was angry about that. I was angry at her. I felt like she took from my son what should be his, and she harmed him, and she didn't take care of him, and she was just a gold dickin', and I had lots of nasty words that were coming out of my mouth, and I called Gary Brown. And because I couldn't get a hold of Weaver, so I called Gary, and just a tirade of profanity is coming out of my mouth, and he's like, "Wow, you're scaring me right now," and that's something if you scared Mr. Brown, and I felt proud in that brief moment. Isn't that sick? But immediately. Immediately he stopped and he said, "Stop. Pray. You've got to calm down, and then you got to write about this. You're wrong. to me, I was, with everything in my being, I was not wrong. She was wrong, and I was ready to go to war to right this wrong. I was ready to take her to court. I'm going to get an attorney, and that attorney is going to be the meanest, dirtiest catfighting attorney I can find. And I'm going to rip her a new one. It was like, ting, 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 ting. I'm going to get her, I'm ready for a fight. And she's going to pay. And I mean, I was like in it. And called him up and was just, and I was justified. Absolutely just. She was wrong. I'm not wrong here. She's wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. I was getting ready to and did, but I hadn't yet. But I was and I was using all to justify the actions I was getting ready to take. Thank God I didn't go find her. I was going to go get some black spray paint on her nice cream colored garage door that my ex-husband bought. White trash lives here, and I'm going to vandalize her cars, those Jaguar, / that 4x4 SUV, trashed, and I'm going to get her kids' cars too, and their kids are going to pay. I mean, I was like in it. Talk about threatened. Woo! And, fire from the mountain was coming down. And she messed with the wrong woman. And so Brown says, whoa, stop. After he listened to my tirade, and he gave a little chuckle, which, I didn't like that either. Because this was way big deal serious to me. And he goes, I want you to pray. I just want you to calm down. You're not ready to write yet. I just want you to try to calm down, and every time this comes up, I want you to go into prayer and before you go causing all kinds of harm. And talk to me in a couple of days, and let's talk about this again. And, everybody that came into contact with me for the next couple of days heard the story. Everybody. I was an equal opportunity demonstrator. Of this, my husband heard about it, that some of the women I sponsor heard about it, Weaver heard about it, everybody got a taste of it, people at work heard about it, and they're all on my side, because I can tell a compelling story, except the really fit ones. They're like, yeah, there's some inventory here. So I had to get quiet and get to a place where I could stay the third step prayer. And I saw myself in this. Am I not being a self-seeker right now? Even with believing through my core that I am right, she is wrong, I am ready to go to war, am I being a self-seeker? I was convinced she's more to blame. Convinced. This isn't about me, this is about her. It wasn't even about my ex-husband. It was about her. And I wasn't even admitting I was somewhat at fault. I didn't have any fault here. None. Self-righteous, justified resentment is the worst. It'll kill us dead. So that's where I was at. So I got prayed up and started writing some inventory and started seeing some interesting things in there and how my self-seeking was showing itself, that it really was about me and about mine. Because if Nick has it, then I've got it too. If my son has it, then I have it too. Still driven by things, money. And that was ugly. I don't like to think of myself in that way today. And I wish I could tell you this happened years ago, but I think it was about 6 months ago. And that was still there. It's mine. I want it. It's mine. You don't get to have that. And you took it from me. So that kind of stuff, real ugly stuff showing up. And the place that I was at was being driven. You know, like they talk about, we get driven, selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our troubles. That was absolutely the root of my trouble at that point, and it has been since. It will continue to be. It always has been. Any problem I've had, that is at the root of it. Sometimes it's taken, I've had to wade through some stuff to find it, but it's always been there. And I've absolutely, all my decisions were based on self. When I was younger, and I used to milk this one. This was one of my favorites. I was raped. And I took that into inventory, and I couldn't possibly see how I was wrong with that. Not at all. I wasn't wrong. They were wrong. And it was three guys. And when I had to take that into inventory, you know, which we'll talk about some, you know, and I had to do that prayer in between third and fourth column, I was still absolutely convinced that I didn't make any decisions based on self. And what was revealed to me is that my decisions based on self was, I snuck out of the house. I wanted to go party. I went out and partied with a bunch of guys that I didn't know. We're all drinking. What did I think was going to happen? God knows I've taken advantage of people sexually. What did I think was going to happen? I wanted to be a part of that. That was my decision based on self. And it doesn't mean that what they did was right, and I'm not co-signing that, but I made a decision based on self, which placed me in a position to be hurt. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to hang out. I wanted to drink with the boys. That's what happened. And then I used it for a long time to be a victim and to judge people and to judge situations, but more than anything, to be a victim, to feel sorry for myself on why I don't measure up or why my life is a mess or why I have to drink this way or why this or why that. That was one of my favorite things. Well, if what had happened to you or what had happened to me, if you'd had my life. And that's just one example. I got a ton of them. I know. Of where I was just, you know, unfairly taken advantage of. And it just set me free in a lot of ways. I absolutely made decisions based on self. Even stuff that happened when I was younger that I could not control. I took all of that and used all of that. Ruthie's story helped me with that. I took experiences that I had when I was younger and made them bigger than what they actually were, added to it, and my God, if you take that stuff to a shrink, they're going to help you make it juicier and intensify that idea of being a victim and why my life hasn't worked out. It's all their fault. If all this stuff had happened to you, you'd live like this too. If you'd been abused and taken advantage of and raped and blah, 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 all that stuff, you do it, you know. That's why I do the stuff I do. So it took away my right to be a victim. And, you know, Don and Jerry talk about all the time. I love the story that Jerry tells about going to Don with his Bill of Rights. I got rights today. And I got the right to be angry. I've got the right to withhold forgiveness. And the spiritual path is complete opposite of that. You know, we surrender all of that. I don't have any more rights. I give them up in the third step. I surrender it all of it. The good and the bad. My will, my thought life, everything I hope to become, be, it's all given over. God's now my director. I go and do what God would have me go and do. I am out of the equation. what I want is out of the equation. And it, there's like, what's the word? Oh, my brain's just going toasty. You know, you got to surrender to win. What are those things called? Yeah. But you can also have what you want here. But you surrender everything. But you'll get what you want. You may not know that that's what you want, but you're going to get it. That's God's sense of humor. So anyway, surrender it all. Y'all want to take a break and then pray? Or y'all want to pray and then take a break? Are y'all ready to take the third step? You want to get on the knees and do it? Sweet, let's do it. Do we tape the prayer? We don't tape the prayer. If not, let's do it again. That's what I used to do with the women I sponsor. Do you feel it? If you don't feel it, we need to do it again. You missed something. You did it wrong. Like you can do this wrong. Can't do it wrong. So after we do the third step, the next direction is to immediately launch into inventory, into a house cleaning. And, you know, it was told to me next means next. Right away. Not sit around and think about it. Not float on the good juju of my third step. But to immediately launch into this house cleaning effort. And I was in a lot of pain, so it was easy for me to do. When I first did that, I launched right away. And I made my list and writing inventory is a simple process. A lot of times it gets, what I have observed is it seems to get very complicated, and it's a very simple process. It's not necessarily an emotional one, although it can be. It's not an intellectual process. It's like just the facts, ma'am. Let's get down to disclosing the damaged and unsalable goods that are going on within you. If my internal life is my business, I'm definitely broke. So I got to find out what's the unusable goods within me. My stock and trade with a world that is not working anymore, and that's caused my failure. And I couldn't fool myself about the value of my character defects anymore. And I talked about this some last night. For me, anger had tremendous value for me. And I couldn't fool myself about the value of that anymore. I couldn't fool myself about the value of greed or lust or whatever. So I had to get down to exact causes and conditions. So I'm sure you're all inventory gurus. I think I told y'all about how I'd like just get caught up in writing inventory all the time, turn into a little navel gazer. And I was told that I needed to open up for business, that I needed to get out of inventory. And that was good advice. And I like it that they talk about from resentment alone stems all form of spiritual disease. So it's the big daddy, the mother load, resentment is for us. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And I've not only has that happened with me, but I've seen that happen profoundly with other alcoholics. People that were really physically ill and getting rid of resentments, changing them physically, where those illnesses departed. Some amazing stuff. For those of you that know Camille Frey, she's got an amazing story in terms of she had so much resentment and it had built up in her back, and she had gotten to the point where they told her you're never going to walk again, and you're going to be on narcotics for the rest of your life. And she submitted herself to this process and got resentment-free, and the woman walks around today without a cane, and she's not on narcotics. I also have noticed that when I am not in the flow of life, when I'm trying to run my life, manage my life, when I'm just head and barrel on into life and I'm not consciously aware or present with anything, I get sick a lot. It shows up physically for me. And I've seen people with a lot of different illnesses that have gotten better once they got rid of resentment. A couple of the women I sponsor were very ill physically. One of them had really bad, she's been diagnosed with chronic fatigue. She was in a nasty depression because of it, of her thyroid. I mean, all kinds of stuff. And they started doing tests after tests after tests. Everything was fine, but she was still exhausted all of the time and not okay physically, and had gone on disability with work. And she was at the end of a really negative relationship in her life, and she had been holding on to that pretty tight and not letting that go, and had just gotten all funky and all wound up in herself. And she submitted herself to that, and she started to get better. And it was after the doctors telling her, we've done everything we can for you now. We don't know why you're still sick. We've done everything we can. So I know that there's, that it really is, mind, body, spirit. They really are connected. They really do have an impact on each other. So, from resentment alone stem all forms of spiritual disease. And my spiritual disease can take a lot of different forms. You know, it can be depression, can be anxiety, my antisocial behavior, a lot of stuff, where I don't want to get out of bed, where I don't want to answer the phone, where I'm starting to isolate, that kind of stuff. So we make a list of people, institutions, or principles with whom we're angry. We ask ourselves why we're angry. Now, when I was told to write out why, it had to be 8 words or less. I did not like that direction because I had a story to tell. And of course, my story, I wanted you to understand every nuance of the story because you needed to see how these other people were wrong. And I wanted you to be on my side. And I needed to tell you the whole story. And that was just ixnade. You know, I wanted to write a novel. And even when I went to go read it that first time, it was like, I don't want to hear all that. What's the resentment? I don't need to hear all this other superfluous stuff. Just get to the point. What's the resentment? And that just like made me sad. So 8 words or less. That was the direction I was given. It was good for me. And how it was pointed out to me is, you know, on the other page with the cause, that those are some pretty serious resentments there. And I was told, I'm sure that the circumstances around those core resentments was all pretty dramatic and there was lots of details to tell, but they got to the core resentment. Didn't have to tell the whole story. Just what's the point here? What are you angry about? Sometimes I needed to write some, though, just to find out what my core resentment was because it was just a mess up here. So sometimes I'd get another piece of paper and just kind of write it out to try to figure out what is my core resentment here. And then I had to go in and start writing about what parts of self were affected, our 7 parts of self, you know, and I was, you know, asked to write out the extended third column about how these different parts of self were affected, and I was also asked to look at in that third column, were there any fears there? Like self-esteem, I'm not enough. You know, well, is that a fear? Are you afraid you're not enough and you never will be? Well, as a matter of fact, yes, that is a fear. So to look at that third column and see if there were any fears there too. And if there was, I just put a little bracket there to remind myself when I got into fourth column. And then I just followed, I was instructed on how to follow the directions here. And it was right on, it was perfect for me. I am always convinced you are more wrong than me when I'm going into inventory. You are always more wrong, always. I have just a minuscule little part in that, if anything. you know, and I want it to be something sweet and cute, like, oh, I'm just withholding forgiveness. Mm-hmm. What a crock of poo, you know? And sometimes that's true and that's valid, but I can't hang my hat on that. And that's what I try to do sometimes, be cute, you know. But this was my experience. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong me, and I stayed sore. So, on my own, you're always more wrong than me. I need God's help in order to see where I'm wrong. I called Don up one time and I was reading him some inventory. Got the fourth column. I said, Don, this is my part. He goes, really? Where does that say that in the big book? I get out my big book. I'm convinced that it's in there because that's what I've heard in meetings. My part, my part, my part, my part, my part. And so I said, it's in there. So I get it out and I start looking. It's not in there. And he goes, Valerie, as long as you have a part, then that means they still have a part. And this is about disregarding the other person involved entirely. It's no longer about them. And there were some resentments that I hadn't gotten free of. And it's because I was still saying my part. I did not disregard the other person involved entirely. To me, I was still holding on. What was going on with me is I was still holding on to how they had wronged me or how I perceived they had wronged me. And that same woman kept showing up on my inventory over and over and over again. I was tired of her. I was tired of writing about her. And, you know, and Don was great for his little zingers. He's like, if I resent you, then you own me, and I hate being owned by, or I don't want to be owned by the people who piss me off. And he was great with those little one-liners. That's very true. And I definitely didn't want to be owned by that woman because she definitely pissed me off. And I'm better than her anyway. So I started to get free once I was given that prayer and just that shift of disregarding the other person involved entirely and asking God to help me to get to that place because I just could not travel there on my own. And some amazing things started happening to me when I started writing fourth column. I started experiencing tremendous amounts of forgiveness in places or towards people that I was never ever going to forgive, ever, ever. And started to experience some compassion towards others, some compassion and understanding with my own weakness, that as much as I am capable of, I have no right to judge anybody else because God knows, look at what I do. And I started to see that and experience that. It wasn't up here. I started to experience it. And it helped me when I went out to make amends because I saw clearly that it wasn't about them anymore. Where have I been wrong? And I got to see stuff. I remember this one time I had to write inventory, and one of the things that came out of there on my faults when I was writing out where I was wrong, you know, about selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, afraid, and I had to write out where was I to blame and what were my faults. So when I wrote out faults, one of the words that came to me was sanctimonious. I didn't know what that word meant. I had to go look it up. That word did not come from me. And what it means is spiritual arrogance. And that's exactly what was going on. Spiritual arrogance. I was sanctimonious. So the Spirit definitely gets involved in this and has brought things to me that I didn't see about myself. Even in talking to other alcoholics or talking to my sponsor, I don't always get clear on what God's going to show me about me. There is something more and greater than human power. Even the best sponsor in the world, there's something greater than the best sponsor in the world. So getting in tune with that and asking for that, and opening myself up to that, I want to see it. And I do believe that we have a merciful Father, that I am given and shown exactly what I need to be given and shown at the time. So the longer I'm sober, the more and more honest my inventories have become, the more and more capable I am of being honest with myself and with others about who I really am and what I've really done. Does anybody have anything they want to say about that, or any experience they want to share? Because we have this that we can pass around. Nope? All right. Next time y'all shout out something, you got to let me get this to you. Because they can't hear on the tape. Thing. Kip. Well, not only Tom, no, there's a couple other people that shared some great stuff. Tom, I love you. And I wrote Fear Inventory. Also, the longer I'm sober, when I was first writing inventory, I had a huge amount of resentments. Just resentments, resentments, resentments. I mean, I think I hated everybody. And today, most of my stuff is fear. I'll have like two or three resentments, and then the rest of it is fear. I'll have like 10 or 15 fears. It's crazy. When I write fear inventory, I write out my fear, and I ask myself why I have that fear, and I just why it down till I can't go any further. And then it says, isn't it because self-reliance failed us? And it's easy for me to say, yeah, self-reliance failed me. So what I do is I write out how self-reliance is failing me. I write down the things that I'm doing or not doing to keep that fear from happening. Because I'm usually taking some kind of action to prevent it, or I'm not doing something. And I tell you, fear is a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways. I've experienced that more than once. You need the mic, Tom?
No, I don't need the mic. Can you explain what you meant by quiet down? Because some people aren't familiar with it.
I'm afraid of being alone. Well, why are you afraid of being alone? It's uncomfortable. Well, why are you afraid of being uncomfortable? I don't know what to do with myself. I don't know what to do with myself. I start to think crazy stuff, and I want to take crazy actions. And then I'm going to do that stuff, and then I'm going to end up drinking. And for me to drink is to die. I mean, that's a... But do you see what I mean by wiring it down? I'm afraid I'll lose my job. Well, why? I won't be able to pay my bills. I will lose my house. I'll end up homeless. I'll have nothing. People won't like me. I'll be judged as a failure. I'll be alone. How will self-reliance fail you? Well, I don't show up to work on time, and when I'm there, I don't work. That's how self-reliance is failing me. Something that Jerry has helped me a tremendous amount with is really taking these principles into work. He goes, Val, treat work like you treat AA. You got a lot of gusto and passion for AA. You show up early. You give everything you've got. You stay late. Do the same thing at work. Show up early. Give it everything you've got. Stay late. Somebody needs something, do it. If something needs to be done, do it. Don't wait for an invitation. God knows I don't wait for an invitation to do something in AA. I go do it. Well, I do. I wanted to start a meeting. I did it. I didn't wait for an invitation. I wanted to start a fellowship of the Spirit. I did it. I didn't wait for an invitation. I want to have a talent show. I did it. I didn't wait for an invitation. Do the same thing at work. There's a lot of things that I can do at work to be of use to the organization that I work for to help make it better. And of course I got to run that by my boss and the other boss and not just take off buck wild. But there's a lot of things I can do to be helpful. I can understand the business that I work in. Take the time to understand what other departments do. I can help create community at work. And those are things that I've started to actively do at work. Take those principles into work. Do what you do in AA, take it to work. Listen, participate, show up on time, show up early. Give more than you take. Leave it better than you found it. All the things that we learn in ANA. I'll tell you a story about how I heard about ANA. I was listening to this old dude in California, old crusty guy named Tom. And we had gone to a meeting. I said, "What did you think about that meeting, Tom?" He said, "It was a good B&B." I'm like, "What's a good B&B?" He goes, "I don't know, but it's not AA. Or it's not ANA." So that's where I heard ANA. So in this wonderful promise that's in here, we let him demonstrate through us what we can do, what he can do, what God can do. This isn't about what I can do. This is about what God can demonstrate through me so I can be an example for somebody else coming in. That God took a wreck of a human being and changed them, changed me. My life doesn't look anything like it used to. One of my prayers is, "Father, I pray that I be filled with your love and spirit. I pray that it flow through me and into the lives of others. I pray that I'm a demonstration of your power." This isn't about Valerie does the works, about God does the works. And a lot of times I mix that up in my mind and it's Valerie doing the works. And that's not true at all. It's God doing the work. It's God's power flowing through all of us. We all have access to the same power. So we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. For a long time, I read that as do. What would God have me do? And I got, "No, dummy. It says be. What would God have you be? Not do." I don't know where I picked that up either. I like put stuff that isn't there. So that was a different shift for me. What would God have me be? Not do. I don't have to go take any crazy action. What would God have me be? It's all over the big book. God would have me be kind, tolerant, useful, giving. A lot of things that God would have me be. But the great thing is to outgrow fear. And I love the way that Don used to say this. He said, "My coper's broke. It's done, gone, it's dead. Coper's broke. I can't cope with fear. I can't walk myself through it. Can't do it. If I could, I would. If there was something more that I could do, there would be more directions. I ask God to remove it, and I'll outgrow it. And then I ask God to direct my attention to what he would have me be. If I could change it, I would, but I can't. I've tried to. Doesn't work. Now about sex. Woo! Let's talk about sex, baby. You know that song, right? Salt and Pepper? Many of us needed an... And I'll outgrow it. And then I ask God to direct my attention to what he would have me be. If I could change it, I would, but I can't. I've tried to, doesn't work. Now about sex. Woo! Let's talk about sex, baby. You know that song, right? Salt and Pepper? Many of us needed an overhauling there. We tried to be sensible on this question. Why? It's so easy to get way off the track, and yes, it is. Romance and finance. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. That was definitely not me. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. That is me to a T. Everywhere, everything. In my relationship, in my marriage, you know, if it is not right, something's wrong. And it's your fault, and you need to step up and change. Demanding, the reason I don't like you right now is because you're not performing as you should. What an awful thing to say to somebody. I'm going to punish you if you don't do it my way because I'm not getting enough of it or the way that I want it. Really, I've been very selfish in my conduct and in my relationships with other people. When they talk about in here, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. That's what I've done my entire life when it came to that, and especially intimate relationships with another human being. I absolutely used it lightly and selfishly. It was absolutely about benefiting me. I was not a nice person in relationships with that stuff. So, boy, it got quiet in here. I know, sex. So we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. And also, we don't want to be the arbiter of anybody's sex conduct. So I've made a lot of mistakes, as you may have been able to discern from what I've shared with you thus far in relationships. And in sponsorship, I have wanted to save women I've sponsored from making the same mistakes. And I have wanted to be the arbiter of their conduct. And I've also wanted to be the arbiter of my husband's conduct. I've had to let that go. With women I sponsor, I can't... that stuff caused me a lot of pain. I created a lot of wreckage with that. So, of course, I want to save them from making the same mistakes that I've made. And what I was told was, why would you want to rob them of their experience? If you stop them from what they're doing, then they got to go back and learn it again. Don't interfere. And that doesn't mean, like, if somebody comes to me and says and tells me this crazy stuff, that I'm like behind it and co-signing it. I don't do that, but I share my experience and I don't try to impose my morals or my beliefs on them or get mad at them, which I've done in the past. Get mad at them when they don't leave that relationship or they don't change. I've learned how to let them have their own experience. And I've sponsored some women who do some funky stuff in that arena. That just doesn't appeal to me. And I don't get it. Like this whole, and not to offend anybody who may be into that lifestyle here, but this whole master-servant thing. Submission, domination. when I was working with this gal and she was explaining that stuff to me, I was like, on the inside, I'm like, holy shit, are you serious? But on the outside, I'm like, wow. That makes sense to you, huh? Yeah. But on the inside, I'm like, really? Really? You let that happen? I mean, I'm like, wow. And it's kind of like, I'd be like the dominant one, you know what I mean? And she was like the servant girl, so I'm like, I don't get that at all. I'm like, do you want to like slam his ass to the ground, you know? I don't get that stuff at all. But I can't be the arbiter of anybody's conduct. So I listen. If that makes sense to you, rock on. But also there's this, and I've been cut off in sponsorship by this. Valerie, I don't want to hear about it anymore. We're done talking about this relationship. Two sickos do not make a willow, and I'm done. I am done hearing about it. I've given you everything I've got. I don't have any new suggestions for you. When you're ready to do something different, you will. I'm done talking about it. And I thought that was quite unfeeling and uncaring. But the reality is I wanted to continue with my behavior without paying a price. I wanted to figure out a way to make it work when it just wasn't going to work, when it just was not happening. But I want to make it happen. I ended up marrying the guy I stalked. And the guy that I was completely obsessed with. The guy that I was hiding behind bushes and spying on and underneath cars and defiling his property. Who was afraid of me. I ended up marrying that guy. And what happened was him and I split, and for the like fourth or fifth time, and I was hoping history would repeat itself, which, you know, when you leave a relationship, you're okay for a little while, and then the real pain shows up, and then you start getting desperate for, maybe it'll work, maybe it wasn't so bad. Let me go, well, I'm different now, I've changed, I understand where I was wrong, and I can be different now. I mean, crazy stuff. And but it got to the point where it was just done. It was over. And thank God he closed the door. I mean, he completely shut the door. If he hadn't done that, if he'd let me worm or weasel in there in any way, I would have done it. And his saying is no tentacles. No tentacles. The door is closed, no tentacles. Don't call me, you know, because I always had a reason to call. I had his stuff. He didn't want that back, so I burned it. Had a little bonfire in his honor. But, you know, I don't want that. Stay away from me. Do not call. Do not show up. You know, we're done. No tentacles. None. I started going to other meetings. He went to other meetings. I didn't see him for about a year and a half, something like that. And then I bumped into him at a meeting again. We went out for coffee. We started talking. And both of us had changed. If we hadn't changed, we couldn't have even considered talking to each other again. And both of us were done. We thought it was over. Him and I would never, ever get back together again. It wasn't, you know, maybe someday in the future it'll work out. None of the, it was gone. It was done. So it was a real surprise when him and I ended up back together again. Because neither one of us ever thought something like that would happen. But I guess that's where we were supposed to be. And we had harmed each other in every possible way that you could harm somebody too. So it was pretty amazing that we were able to come back together. But we were different people. The same people could not have engaged upon a relationship again. it would have destroyed it. Or we would have destroyed it. The same people would have had the same experience. So we had both changed a lot. And not that it's been easy at all. It's been very difficult at times. Sometimes I've woken up in the morning and I'm like, my life sucks and it's all your fault. I hate you. I mean, I wake up with that thought. You know, and the reason I'm unhappy, it's his fault. And he better get busy making my life better for me, you know? So, you know, that kind of thinking will still show up sometimes, and I really understand that he's not responsible for my happiness. And each of us, each have our own life in AA. We lead our own life. We don't... he comes to my home group, but I... because my home group is superior, of course. I'm just kidding. A little. Anyway, no, really, I am kidding. He's got a fine home group. But like, he comes to my home group, but I don't go to his. That's the only meeting we go to together, and we don't even ride in the same car together, because if one of us stays late afterwards talking to another drunk, you know, he works with his sponsor, and what he's doing in his program is his deal. And it's not any of my business, and I don't interfere. We don't argue about Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. If he shares something with me, that's great, but if he doesn't, that's okay too. My happiness is not dependent on him at all. If that relationship ended tomorrow, I would be sad, I would be devastated, or something happened to him, I would be sad. It would hurt tremendously, but I would be fine, and I know that. And I know that at depth. It's not an intellectual thing. I know it. Because my well-being is not with him. My identity is not with him, which is where it used to be in the past. I'm very much my own woman. So we come together and we do this thing together. He's incredibly supportive of me and what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very grateful. I don't think I could do what I do in AA if it wasn't for him. He's absolutely a rock in our life. He went out of town one time, and I have a son, Nick. And so Alex was out of town, and he goes, when's Alex coming back? And I'm like, he'll be back tomorrow. And he goes, I hope he comes back soon, because, you know, when he's out of town, we don't eat right. We don't go to bed on time. The laundry doesn't get done, you know. I mean, he, like, keeps things hopping. I'm like the woo-hoo-hoo-hoo, you know, and he's the complete opposite of me. In a lot of ways. How it was described to us one time is, I make sure he has some fun, and he makes sure I don't go too far, you know? So we have a good time together. And he is my best friend. My best friend. I can talk to him about anything. He is absolutely one of my confidants. I trust him with my life, and I trust him with everything that I am. And that's a new experience for me, because I was always posing or pretending or hiding. And he loves me for everything that I am, and vice versa. And that's a different experience. I was talking to Tom about this the other day, that Camille used to say, with alcoholics, you got two selfish, self-centered people that both want to be right, so it's rough going. So they both better be on a path, or it's going to be ugly, you know? Anyway, all right. Oh, in my relationship with my husband, there have been things that I have wanted him to change about himself. In order for our marriage to be a happy, more comfy place for me. And I felt that these things were worthy causes, and that these things would enrich our relationship. And he would be happy, I would be happy, life would be good if he would change these things. We had many discussions about these things. Some were sane, and some were knockdown dragouts. Sometimes I'd get mad and punish and I'm not talking to you, and I'm absolutely going to withhold everything from you. That'll teach you. When you're done suffering with what you're getting, you'll change. None of that worked. We change on God's timetable. Alex has not changed on Valerie's timetable. And I'm sure there have been things about me that he really wished would change right away. And we have been changed on God's timetable. And, you know, there have been numerous times in my marriage where I'm like, do I stay? Do I go? I don't know what to do. Father, you know, this doesn't seem to be working out. If I'm supposed to be here, give me the power to stay. If I'm supposed to leave, give me the power to go, because I don't know. We've argued about stuff back and forth and tried to fix things on our own, and we're going to change on our own, and it didn't work, and we had to bring God into it. God, we don't know. We give up. We don't know what to do, so we're giving it to you. You do it. We can't. We've tried. So God has changed it, and God has changed us individually, and we got out of the way and got busy with Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything's been fine. Not without difficulty, but it's been great. What's been neat is to see these changes happen years down the road, and after I have had to go look at myself and where I'm wrong and where my expectations are, and I'm surrendering that stuff and letting him be who he is, where he's at, and with his spiritual path and his spiritual life, that truly he does not need to change in order for me to be happy, which was huge for me, because I'm somebody who always thinks the grass is greener on the other side. That's the kind of mind I have. It'll be different over there. Instead of sticking where I'm at and looking at myself. Where am I wrong? Where am I being selfish in this relationship? And this conduct inventory that's in here has enabled me to go look at that stuff and how I show up in a relationship. When I first wrote this, some of my major relationships, I answered specific questions on this. On each relationship, and the rest of the stuff, it was all piled in there together. I didn't do it person per person, because it says we reviewed our conduct over the years past. So I'm looking at it on the whole. And like I said, some of those relationships I needed to look at those individually. Did I say lick? That might have been a Freudian slip. Anyway. Because we're talking about sex. Yeah, I know. I'm not foul. Naughty mind. But answering these questions, and then the list develops of who's been harmed when I start answering these questions. And answering these questions, subjecting each relationship to this test, was it selfish or not? Every relationship was selfish. Not one wasn't. Every single one of them was. I was always looking for something from somebody. And I love this piece about writing our ideal, about, in answering that question, what should I have done instead, and from that creating an ideal. And I used to... My first ideal I wrote for what my mate needed to be. And then I was told, no, it's an ideal for you, honey. This is about what you want to become. What you want to become in a relationship. And I love what Elkin said. And his was, you know, because I want to write something all flowery and beautiful. And full of self-sacrifice and all this other crazy stuff. And his was to give more. That simple, to give more. I like that. Just to give more. Not be such a taker. To be aware of other people around me. To be aware of my husband. And that he is not there to serve me. To take a genuine interest in his life and what's going on in his life. To actively ask questions about how are you? What's going on with you? And this prayer that's in here is wonderful. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is often desirable. Yes, it is. But we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. And I have stumbled many times in my ideal. But I haven't gone out and gotten drunk because I followed the rest of the directions. If we're sorry for what we've done, and I have the honest desire to let God take me to better things, we believe we'll have been forgiven and learned our lesson, and I had to learn a lesson a couple of times. I did the same crazy stuff over and over. But I finally got it. And I'm sure that'll continue to happen. I'll continue to make mistakes for my ideal. But to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. That has been paramount for someone like me because I have used it and abused it for so long. It's easy for me when I get uncomfortable to go back to what I know. I mean, it's instant ease and comfort for me. Just like a drink. It's like a drink on two legs. And it can be something as simple as I meet some guy and I just start talking inappropriately. What's a little flirtation between friends? But with something like that, with me, it's danger, danger, Will Robinson, danger. And someone who helped me a lot with that was Gary Brown. Because he was a pig too. And, well, he was. And he'll talk to you about it. And that's what he shared with me. When that comes up, prayer immediately, and I do not put myself in situations where that even has the remote opportunity of happening. Because I know me. And I'm responsible for my sobriety today. I am absolutely 100% responsible for my conduct. So, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. Some people say that's why I sponsor so many women, because I got a lot of problems with sex, baby. We think of their needs and we work for them. It takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge. And that's exactly what it is for me. When to yield would mean heartache. And that's exactly what happens to me. Guilt, remorse, horror. The four horsemen show up in a nasty little way for me if I engage in that stuff. And I can't afford it. The price is too high. And thank God for that. Thank God for that. So this stuff works. And I had this experience where I became convinced that God could remove whatever self-will was blocking me off from him. Because it was clearly demonstrated for me, and I absolutely started to experience the nearness of my Creator when I started writing this stuff down. And being willing to look at myself honestly and take stock honestly and what I'm capable of doing and what I have done. It's not only what I have done. But that understanding of I'm absolutely capable of anything given the right circumstances. And that delusion that I'm a nice person got smashed at depth. And that I don't deserve anything. And a powerful prayer that I heard is, thank you, Father, for everything that you've given me. And thank you, Father, for everything you've taken away. So, inventory. We wrote it. Time to go read it. The thing that really helped me with the fifth step was when it talks about alcoholics lead double lives, two hours leading triple, quadruple lives. When I was out there, I absolutely led a double life. When I was in New York, I was a fine art rep by day, and at night I was riding a Harley, hanging out with bikers. Now, there's anything wrong with that, but and carrying a Walther PPK because I thought it was cute, and wearing a skull and crossbones do-rag. So I'm Miss Pris fine art rep by day, and at night I'm hanging out with the bikers in the biker bar, carrying a gun. Those are two distinct pictures. You know what I mean? But I lead a double life. And I can do that sober. This is what I want you to see, but the reality of how I'm really living can be something entirely different. I like it in Alcoholics Anonymous when people share exactly who they are, warts and all. That has more of an impact on me than anything. When people share their faults, I want to know the truth. Strong sponsorship has given me that gift of them demonstrating that with me, with their life being an open book. And I've also given my sponsor the right to come into any area of my life and poke around. My sponsor doesn't have to ask for permission. My sponsor can go into any area of my life. And I actually give that too, and sometimes I've regretted it, in an appropriate way to the women that I sponsor. They get to see every area of my life. I have learned in sponsorship too that I don't need to share everything. That some things I need to just share with my sponsor. If it's appropriate and will help another alcoholic one-on-one, I can do that. And it's not about keeping secrets. I don't mean it that way. But my life needs to be an open book. It's too easy for me to lie and be a phony. One of the things, too, that helped me with that was my first big inventory that I wrote doing it this way. I went out to Louisville, Kentucky to fifth step it. And this was a big deal. This inventory was very, very fragile. And I was very wounded. And Camille sat me in her damn sunroom. And she sent this woman that I didn't even know in that sunroom and said, read it. I was mad. And I was hurt. I was like, I didn't come here to read this to this woman. I came here to read this to you. What are you doing to me? And I was really hurt by it. But I read it. And then she sent somebody else in there, said, read it to her. So I read it to her. She must have been talking to Brown, got that nifty idea from him. So I read it to her, and then finally I got to read it to Camille. But what happened is, at that point in my sobriety, I was absolutely living a double life. You know, I'd spout out good AA stuff, but I wasn't telling you the truth about what was going on. It's easy to sound good in AA. I mean, you can get it down. You can get the talk down. It's easy to sound good here. Well, maybe. I don't know. But what happened to me is my ego got leveled at depth. I found out that I wasn't different. When I was reading that inventory, I thought that I was sicker than everybody else, that you guys hadn't thought this stuff.